How much time? 30 seconds. I'm on right now. I don't believe you.
Run.
What?
You're listening to The Hockey Show on 101.5 UMFM.
All right, we're on.
Ready, Phil?
We're on in 5, 4.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? Good evening.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Hockey Show here on 101.5 UMFM, Canada's only campus-produced radio show that strictly talks hockey. Glad to have you with us, everybody, tonight. A little bit of a change in the format tonight, though, is Jenna not with us tonight. She is writing an exam, so she is off and getting edumacated, which is always good. In her place, we had to actually bring in two illustrious guests, although their contributions are always appreciated. Let's start with the first gentleman. You know him from being on the show often. He's always got a good opinion on hockey. Jason Pajak, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back.
Good to have you back. And the second one, definitely an opinionated guy, likes to pop into the show every now and then. We are proud. We are honored to have GM Jared with us tonight. Jared, how are you?
Thebes, I'm doing good, buddy. But the pleasure is all mine. Thanks
for having me. On. It's never a pleasure to deal with me, you tell me. So it's all good. Just want to start things off quickly. Couple of announcements. The Lamoureux twins, Monique and Jocelyn Lamoureux, have announced their retirement from international hockey, which pleases and displeases me, only because A, it pleases me that they won't terrorize Canada anymore, but B, it displeases me because they were two of the original UND soldiers that they made put UND on the map, and certainly were phenomenal players in their own right. So anybody, if either of you want to jump in with a Lamoureux thought, please feel free here, because I mean, they were legitimately superstars in their own right in the women's hockey game.
And I mean, like, it's important to say, like, the way that they put UND on the map, like, without that program, we probably wouldn't have had the Lamoureux twins in the state that they were. And to lose programs like that, it has downstream effects, and we may have lost another pair. We may have lost, you know, a generation of players like the Lamoureux twins by losing a program like UND.
I will say that might not be true, Jason, and I only know that because I've had the opportunity to read their book, which comes out in 11 days on February 22nd, Dare to Dream. The Lamoureux twins have published their story on hockey. Fantastic book. If you're going to pick up a book to read during this pandemic-y time, that one is definitely worth the money, because they go over their career in fine detail, from the good to the bad to the getting cut and not liking it stories. So it's good. It's good. I got to say, it's very good. But again, the other retirement, as we get into the show here, Mikko Koivu retired. Mikko playing 1,300 games, I think, is the total with the Wild, and 7 with the Columbus Blue Jackets before saying that was enough. So Mikko Koivu, one of those great sort of Finnish players that always seemed to find the back of the net, obviously joined his brother Saku now in retirement. But at the same time, though, another good player hanging up the skates after a while. And we'll start in Columbus today, because I know that you guys are going to have opinions on this, with Patrick Laine being benched for 27 minutes at the end of the game in a 2-2 tie, which eventually was a 3-2 win for Columbus, but in a 2-2 tie with the Carolina Hurricanes. Patrick Laine sat down by John Tortorella for 27 minutes in that game. Thoughts on his benching?
Well, so, I mean, obviously, as soon as Laine was traded to Columbus, the watch was on, right? People speculating, when is he going to get on Tort's bad side? When is this going to happen? These two are like oil and water. They're not going to mix. And I think that this benching came a lot quicker than most folks anticipated. But what was interesting to me was today, you know, when the sort of the aftermath, it kind of blew up, was that Laine was, at least in the statements that I saw, seemed pretty contrite and accepted what went on. And apparently it came after an altercation that he had with one of the assistant coaches, and that he might have gotten a little bit mouthy. And I mean, if you've followed any of the teams that John Tortorella has coached, you know that that sort of thing doesn't fly. And to what I will say is that if everything it reads the way that it read, then good on Patrick Laine for accepting some sort of culpability, and good on John Tortorella for running his room the way that he wants to run his room. I mean, I like the guy. He's a little bit old school, but I really appreciate the way that he does things. He makes me laugh too. So, you know.
Yeah. And I totally agree. Like I have a problem with when people say, oh, well, he got benched. Like, so what? It's a punishment, right? It's a move that the team is making, or that the coaching staff is making, to send a message and to get the most out of their players. Like, we have this tendency to see a player being benched or being held out of the lineup as some miraculous career or franchise altering decision, when it doesn't have to be. Like, everyone knew before Dubois got benched that he was on his way out of Columbus. I'm pretty sure Paul Maurice would have been at a point where he wanted to bench Laine 100 times while he's with the Jets. Like, it's just a thing that goes on in a room. And John Tortorella is just a guy that's not afraid to flex that. Like, a lot of coaches in higher level hockey, especially the NHL, are afraid to step in on their big guys like that, to bench a player like a Patrick Laine or Pierre-Luc Dubois, because players, for better or for worse, because of the dollars they bring in or they command in salary, are almost untouchable by a lot of coaches in where punishments are concerned. So I think it's a great way. It's a great thing from Tortorella. It sent the message that it needed to. It shows a lot of maturity on Patrick Laine's part to take that punishment and roll with it and learn from it. I don't see anything wrong with the way it was.
I mean, I'll agree in that. I think that Patrick Laine, as a 22-year-old, maybe he knows how good he is in terms of, you know, I can shoot the puck like nobody else, and let's be honest, you're not going to bench me. My thing is that, again, Tortorella doesn't care who you are. He's benched guys like Cam Atkinson, Anthony Duclair. He benched Roberto Luongo at the Winter Classic. Like, he doesn't care who you are. If you spout off or you don't follow the way that he wants you to play, you're going to sit. It's as simple as that. And I look at Tortorella's teaching moment there and look at it almost like Barry Trotz with Alexander Ovechkin when he was trying to convince him to play defense in order to win a Stanley Cup. In that, if you didn't play Trotz's way and you didn't follow his lead, you weren't playing. And some people will go, it's not quite the same. It's not quite the same. Torts is a little different than a coach than Barry Trotz. But like you said, Jared, he got the message across, because it sounds like Laine understood that he did wrong. And that's exactly what you want to hear from your player if you're a coach after sitting a player like that. He knew he did wrong. He accepts the punishment, and we're going to move on now. So it's over and done with, which is, I think, for Columbus, the best thing that could happen, considering all the fires they've been putting out this season.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, you know what? The guy has been a coach in the league for 20 years, off and on now, right? You do not achieve that sort of longevity if you do not know how to push the buttons and when is the right time to do it. And, you know, of course, he knew exactly how it was going to blow up in the media. And he knew exactly what was going to happen, benching the new star player 4 games into his stint with the team. But if he doesn't do that, he's not true to himself. And at that point, he loses the room. And guys are going to try and run rampant over him. And it's not going to end well. And people are already speculating that, you know, this might be the last year for him in Columbus anyways. He might have worn out his welcome and whatever. But hats off to Torts, because he's his own guy and he's going to do what he's going to do, and more power to him.
Well, I mean, I just don't understand why it's such a big story. Like, this is something that we should just expect from John Tortorella. Like, Teebs, as you said, he's benched Cam Atkinson before, Anthony Duclair. Like, he probably, if he had Rick Nash, he probably would have benched him at some point in his career with Columbus too. Like, it's part of the deal when you're coached by John Tortorella that he's going to do things like this, and it's one of the tools in his tool set. Like, why is this even big news for us at this point? aside from the fact that it's Patrick Laine getting benched, you know, X number of games after being traded for a player that also got benched. Like, it's...
Well, and let's take nothing away from Tortorella, because he benched another player that night too. Dean Kukin didn't see the ice midway through the second period till the end of the game either. Not like Dean Kukin is anywhere as important, you might think, as a guy like, you know, Patrick Laine. But essentially, they went down to five defenders that night and still won the game against a very good Carolina Hurricanes squad. So, I mean, it's, we're focusing on the one guy, the big name, and meanwhile, he's doing it to other players at the same time, and we're not even noticing it. Like, that's the thing, is that I look at this, and like you said, Jared, I mean, this is Tortorella to a T. If you don't play the way that he wants you to play the game in his style, you aren't playing the game. He'll sit you for as long as he has to. He'll make you dress, and then he'll sit you for 60 minutes if he has to, just to send a message. And I think that's, we don't see enough coaches. I'm not talking about the local guy. I mean, maybe you'll read into this a little bit, but we don't see enough coaches. We don't see enough coaches really coming out and saying, it's either my way or the highway, and I don't care who you are or what you're being paid to be here. If you don't play the way that, again, how many Stanley Cups has Patrick Laine won? Zero. How many Stanley Cups has Tortorella won? One. It gives Tortorella a bit of an advantage in terms of the way that he's getting his message across. He's won before. He knows what it takes. So I look at this and I go, honestly, like you said, Jason, we're blowing this way out of proportion.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I mean, locally, it's a story because it's a big "I told you so" or a chuckle amongst the local media, and you know, social media locally blows up because this is exactly what people were waiting for, right? These two diametrically opposed folks to clash, and yeah, big deal.
The other guy that went over there in that trade has turned out to be the second coming of Rick Nash, is Jack Roslovic is doing everything and more for John Tortorella. Thoughts on Jack Roslovic and how good he's looked so far for Columbus?
You know, when a player moves to a new system after being, or a new place after being with one team for a while, there's really two ways that it can happen. You know, we could see a situation where it takes a while for them to get used to the way that, you know, that particular team plays, or the way that, like, the city, the preparation, like, so much changes when you change cities, when you change teams. Or you can take it and you can run with it. And I think Jack Roslovic right now is running with it. He's got that bump. I don't think it's gonna, I don't know at this point if it's awakened some, you know, latent top six forward level skill in him. But I think it's been a good start for him in Columbus. He's obviously happy there. He's from there. He knows the town. He's close to his family. So that all contributes to him being more comfortable and being happier. And really, he's the kind of guy that would fit with a John Tortorella, I think. Honestly, if I were coached by John Tortorella, he's the type of guy, the type of coach that I would go through a wall for. And I think for Jack Roslovic, it's the same way.
Yeah, to me, it doesn't come as a major surprise. Obviously, the clip that he's producing at right now, it might be a little surprising if you look at past performance. But, you know, this is a player who was drafted in the first round. He was at the very top of the Jets prospect list pretty much right from the jump. And like Jay said, he ran into a depth problem here. There just wasn't a place for him to play on that top six, which, you know, okay, so you get in there, you earn your bones the first couple of years, but then a player like Jack Roslovic, who has been relied on offensively on every team that he's probably ever played on, is going to feel stymied when he is on that third line or he is on that fourth checking line. So for him to be able to go to what is essentially a perfect situation in Columbus, his hometown notwithstanding, and his family has been season ticket holders since the Blue Jackets came into the NHL, sitting a couple rows behind the bench, apparently. But for him to be able to play in front of his friends, his family, and to, more importantly, to get an opportunity to contribute in a way that he feels like he's always been able to contribute, it's got to do wonders for a player's confidence. And you're seeing the byproduct of that on the ice. Now, I guess my question would be, if you put him in a different situation where he's not playing in his hometown, but he's still getting the same top 6 minutes. Are you seeing the same results?
I think you would. He's always had that ability. It just took the right opportunity. Like I'm just looking at his stats right now. Like my first thought was seeing the way that he was producing was like, oh, he's got to be on a PDO bender. Like, well, not really. He's at 101 right now. The one thing you can kind of say like, oh, he's shooting at 20% when his career average is around 11. So that's probably going to start coming down, but he's still like, you can't take away the fact that it's the opportunity that really reigns supreme here. I think.
Can I be honest about his, before you go on, Jay? Cause
yeah.
I think you're right about the PDO, you know, not being surprising. He's a centerman. He's never been a winger. He shouldn't have played on the wing in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what people think about. I know that we have, you know, Lowry and Kopp and Scheifele and Wheeler was playing center for a while. And we had all these guys that essentially were filling in where Jack Roslovic probably could have filled in that second line role fairly nicely if given the opportunity. But him playing as a winger was never his strength.
It's a different mentality entirely.
Right. And seeing him skate with the puck now through the, like down the ice I watched some of that Carolina Columbus game the other night. Fantastic. He looks like he's confident with the puck. He has no fear of turning it over. I know that, again, Torts will tear him a new one if he turns it over and gives up a goal at a blue line. That's understood. But the confidence he's skating with as a centerman looks entirely different than the confidence he had or the lack of confidence that he had here in Winnipeg. And I think that feeds into it a lot in that he's back in his natural position and feels more at home.
Mm-hmm. Well, like that's the thing. Like when you're a centerman, you're supposed to be a play driver. And when you grow up playing center, you grow up with that mentality. You grow up with the kind of the quarterback mentality. Like the play runs through you when you're in the offensive zone. You've got more assignments. You've got more things to think about. So you get used to that and you get used to being the guy that's going to drive play and move play forward. And realistically, I think the only guy the Jets have left right now that's driving play, and this is a conversation I've had with my friends while watching the games this year, is Nick Ehlers. He's the only guy that looks like he's driving play down through the neutral zone for the Jets, getting them consistent zone entries with possession. And like that's something that Roslovic didn't have a chance to really exercise playing on the wing for the Jets. So I think, yeah. Like,
but he did when he was playing with the Moose, though. That's the key, mm-hmm. is that they moved him to the wing when Maurice got his grips on him. And I just go, you can't keep destroying these good young centermen that you're drafting as good young centermen by plugging them in on the wing. It's not the same position, and it's not a position that they're comfortable with.
And throwing away first-round picks to get a second-line center when you could have developed one,
right?
Namely Jack Roslovic. And now, I mean, Cole Perfetti is going to, you know, do Cole Perfetti things, but...
But again, if Cole Perfetti ends up on a wing, is Cole Perfetti... I mean, Cole Perfetti as a winger at the World Juniors was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Cole Perfetti as a centerman, completely different player at that point. And that's where I look at it and I go, there needs to be this glut of centermen that we do have is always going to be a strength, but it's also going to be a huge hindrance for any player that's trying to come up through the system as a centerman as well, because there's no room for you. So I don't know if we're going to see Cole Perfetti become the next great centerman after... I mean, again, people are talking about him slotting in the second line spot where Stastny is. If Stastny moves on this year, I don't know if we're going to see that, though. I don't know if that's going to be something that's going to be an option, because I don't know if Paul Maurice appreciates the fact that we have a natural young centerman who's as good as Perfetti that doesn't have the NHL chops yet.
I think his mentality is, you know, you can teach a guy to play wing when that's a difficult... Like, people have this misconception that playing wing is like the easiest thing to fix. Like they're the easiest commodity to find in the league. But actually teaching a guy that's been a center to be a winger is a difficult task. And with Paul Maurice, if he has this mentality that like, oh yeah, we've got a guy that, you know, should be effectively skill wise our second line center. Oh, that means I can make him a first line winger or a second line winger. It won't be too hard for him, when realistically, like, that's not...
It's not the way that it works, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know what? I think that also what it comes down to is opportunity. And, you know, you're also seeing it in Winnipeg with Nick Ehlers, who you mentioned. All of a sudden, you know, he's getting different opportunities because his old buddy Laine is on his way to Columbus. And the last stretch of games, he's played, I think, the best hockey that I've seen him play in Winnipeg. Like, he seems like he's skating with so much more confidence. And I mean, he was by far the best Jet forward two nights ago against Calgary. And, you know, like it seems, it's just interesting to see how as pieces shift one way or the other, the byproduct of what can come of it, right?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you brought up two nights ago against Calgary because we got our first look at Pierre-Luc Dubois, who came back in that Line A Roslovic trade. Didn't think that Dubois had a bad game, but certainly there was a handful of Jets that did. It didn't look like they were... It looked like they had been off for a number of days. Essentially, they looked rusty. And I know that there are built-in gaps in the schedule to allow for, you know, for time to recover and all that kind of stuff. But I'm thinking that the downtime is actually hurting the Jets more than helping them. Thoughts on the game? Thoughts on, first of all, Pierre-Luc Dubois, and then what the rest of the Jets looked like as well.
So what I would say is the guy has got to show some level of rust. I mean, he hasn't played in a competitive game in 14 days, 15 days. And the last game that he played in, he got sat and didn't really see a whole heck of a lot of ice time. But I think that what you saw in the game against Calgary and the sort of the sluggishness and almost tiredness, I would also chalk up to the fact that Paul Maurice made wholesale line changes outside of that first line. And he, you know, for the first period, he had Trevor Lewis playing up on the second wing in more of an offensive type role, which is not something that he's been accustomed to for the last, what, 7-8 years of his career. He's not been seen to be that sort of guy. And I think that it might have been a better play to maybe integrate things in a more casual manner. Like, they mixed and matched everything, with the exception of Scheifele, Kopp, and Ehlers, who have been dynamite since they got put together. But I didn't really see the reasoning for shifting wingers around. I mean, if you kept talking about, oh, you know, when Dubois comes in, Winnipeg's going to have the best center depth in the league. Well, to me, that means that maybe your centerman just kind of everybody shifts down one level. And you keep the wingers together because there's some sort of sense of chemistry there. But, you know, who am I? I'm just a guy on the couch watching the game. So, and I think that the other problem is playing against the same team for four games in a row.
Yeah.
It's got to be tiresome. It's just like you look across the ice or, you know, on the other side of the glass at that other bench, and it's just like, ah, oh, geez, it's these guys again. Like, didn't we just get rid of these guys? Like,
it could be worse because, I mean, St. Louis and Arizona now are playing a 7-game series in the middle of the season. Like, they're playing 7 times against each other in a row because of all the postponements in the States. I agree with you. Like, I mean, how many times can you play the same team and not have, oh, we know exactly where this puck is going because we've played you how many times in a row now? Like, the systems don't change that often. So there aren't a lot of surprises by the time you get to game number 3 or 4, right?
But then the Jets get to throw Calgary the biggest curveball and say, we have a brand new top 6 center to throw at you and a guy that plays, you know, kind of Matthew Tkachuk style hockey. Maybe not to the degree that Matthew Tkachuk plays, but that kind of physical crash and bang, big body style. And one of my friends, we watched the games together on a big Discord call. She joined the game late and asked, like, how well is Dubois played? And the group of us were sitting there scratching our heads. We're like, I don't know. Like, I haven't seen him tonight. I haven't seen him, you know, play all that well or him been that visible. So it wasn't a bad debut in the way that he did something that made you see him in a wrong way. But I think the position that he was put in was kind of a weird one for a debut, especially for a guy of his caliber.
Yeah. And what I will say, not to jump in before you there, Teeps, you had something to say, but I think that, you know what, he came out flat in the first period and the layoff can be expected for that. And I think that as the game went on, he maybe started to get his legs a little bit. You saw a couple flashes here and there. You saw a couple of sort of turns back up the ice and a couple of nice sort of touch passes back and forth with Kyle Connor. And I think that, you know, what maybe helped was swapping Appleton for Lewis and like that's a lot of speed on that second line. And those guys can play kind of an up-tempo game. And I think it's a good position for Appleton to get thrown into as well, right? Because people have talked about him as being a potential, you know, scoring threat for the Jets. But along the same lines as Roslovic, he's never really got that chance to crack that top six. So, sure, we're going to all judge it because it's the first game with the shiny new toy. But on the other hand, you know, let's see where he's at three, four games down the road.
The one thing I didn't like, and I mean, people can criticize me all they want for this and just say you're piling on the one guy that, you know, everybody seems to be piling on right now. But I didn't like the fact that Maurice sort of tried to insulate him by putting Wheeler on the wing. I think that if you're acquiring a guy of Pierre-Luc Dubois' caliber, you let him go out there with an Appleton, a couple of young speedy guys, a couple of guys that are more his age, and let him go bananas. Like, just let him go, take the reins off and let him skate. And I get it. He came out a little flat and he looked a little flat in the first period, like you said, Jared. But honestly, putting him with Wheeler doesn't do anything for him. He's not like, it's not that kind of relationship like a Shifley Wheeler was. It's a Pierre-Luc Dubois debut. Let him go out there with the young guys and work the puck around and cycle the puck a little bit and get that going, because that's more his game than it is that, you know, the run and gun kind of game that Wheeler and Shifley played. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. But I just didn't like the fact they tried to shelter him with a guy like Wheeler, who we know can score, but can't really keep up with the speed of a Pierre-Luc Dubois.
I think you're 100% correct. Like, going back to what Jared said about putting Mason Appleton with him, I think putting Blake Wheeler with Pierre-Luc Dubois is just a complete style mismatch. Like, you put Pierre-Luc Dubois in a line because he creates space. Being a power forward, he'll go to the dirty areas, he'll go root out pucks, and that's what you expect out of Blake Wheeler, or what you would expect out of him is to go into the dirty areas, go to the corners, get the puck, move it around. If you put him with a Mason Appleton, suddenly you've got Appleton and Dubois together driving play through the neutral zone and both creating a lot more space for Kyle Connor, who isn't a play driver, he's not a setup man, he's a finisher. You put him in a position where you can get him the puck, he can get a shot away and get a good angle on the net. So you get him two guys in Appleton who has that finishing ability and Dubois who also has shown some finishing ability. And you put those three together and suddenly you've got a very deadly set of skills on one line. Like, it just feels like Blake Wheeler's spot and his role on any line that he's been put on is kind of redundant at this point.
Well, and this was the big conversation, right, this past week is, okay, so PLD is coming in this week, and what are they going to do? What are the lines going to look like? Well, what's, because, you know, prior to this game, the Jets had been riding a really, really good crest, and it's like the lines had kind of shaken out a little bit post line A departure. I mean, line A only played the first game of the year, but Shifley seemed to find like that immediate chemistry with Kopp and Ehlers. And it kind of dispelled this idea for the longest time that, well, you got to play Shifley and Wheeler together. That's the golden duo right there. And, you know, it's,
can I offer something to, before you go on here, can I offer something on that though? Because you just pointed out the fact that Kopp and Ehlers made Shifley sort of the better player after that. They also did the same thing for Stastny. Is this not more of a reflection on how good Kopp and Ehlers are? And if put a guy like Pierre-Luc 100%. Dubois between them, oh my God, your second line is now great. Put Wheeler back with Shifley, who wants to play together. I mean, those guys have been begging to play together. Put those two guys back together and let them fight through whatever they're fighting through. But give that Ehlers and Kopp a huge boost with a monster in the middle like a Pierre-Luc Dubois.
Well, and this is kind of what I was saying, right, is that I was surprised when the practice happened on Sunday and then the line combos leaked on Monday. And it's just like, okay, so this is what's happening. This is, you know, like it wasn't the expected, oh, well, the centerman's going to shuffle down the line, right? It's just the idea that because Stastny, Ehlers, and Kopp was a great line, and right, they were flying. Everybody was producing on that line, right? And then it allows that old sort of familiar top line to continue with Connor and Wheeler and Shifley. But the problem is like, obviously you're not bringing in Pierre-Luc Dubois and putting him on the third line. And you know, the other thing is, and I know this is sort of beyond the point, but I feel bad for a guy like Lowry, who has, again, stepped up his game. And I think he's been playing the best hockey of his Jets career as well. And now he's down on the fourth line and presumably not going to get as much ice time. Now, I know that they're saying that they're going to roll more consistent fourth lines. And I mean, depth-wise, in the shortened season, with all of the weird breaks and travel and whatnot, that this will play to their advantage, that they can roll four true lines. But I don't know. It doesn't feel like the matches have been set quite yet. And it's good to know that there are other combos that they know have worked that they can put back together.
I feel it's finally time for the Jets to move away from this whole first, second, third, fourth line mentality where, you know, Scheifele will be out there for 20 minutes a night. And then once you peter down to the fourth line, they're out there for seven. Like, Paul Maurice has trusted Adam Lowry to shut down Connor McDavid, and he's done a pretty good job. He's done, I think, a great job of, you know, when he's matched up against the top talent from other teams, because he's good at that. Like, to have a weapon like that where you can throw out a guy, like, you can throw out your fourth line and shut down the top six of another team, and then suddenly they go off for a change. Your first line, or quote-unquote first line, comes over the boards, or you throw the Scheifele line, the Dubois line out there, and they get to roll against a third or fourth line of another team. That's an immediate boon for you, because you're able to create those mismatches because like Jared said, you're able to roll those four lines. It's not about, you know, numbering the lines and you play them in a certain order. It's you take the Barry Trotz approach and you just match based on ability and based on strategy.
I don't disagree with that. I think that Lowry's having the best start to his season out of any season I've seen him play in a Jets uniform so far. I think that Lowry deserves an opportunity to play more time. I think the key on this whole thing, though, and this is where I wonder, and I know he's already said that he's willing to do whatever it takes, but I think the key in this whole equation now is that Paul Stastny is kind of the odd man out. Like, you can't really bump a Scheifele. You're not going to bump a Dubois, and you're certainly not going to tell a Lowry that he has to play less time when he's playing as well as he can. Like, Stastny might not kind of fit anymore. And that's not to say that he needs to go down to the fourth line, but that might mean he has to go and play a winger position. And Stastny can do that. Stastny's been in the league long enough and certainly been around long enough that he can move to the wing. But you'd still have, I mean, again, I look at it and you'd still have a pretty good checking line if you had Stastny, Lowry, and Lewis together. Like, that line alone would just crush the other, you know, other teams in terms of A, their physicality, and B, just their dogged determination on the ice. I mean, it sets up a bad fourth line situation in that you don't really have a centerman for your fourth line now. But I mean, again, Harkins can probably handle that role in between. And I know they keep talking about trying to bring back Nate Thompson for whatever reason. I don't know what the fascination is with Nate Thompson, but again, you can find three players to play 7 minutes a night on that fourth line. I'm not saying that Appleton and Harkins deserve that, but at this point, that might be the reality the Jets have.
And I think that that's, sorry, and I know he's a big favorite here, but I think that at this point, 7 to 10 minutes is exactly what Mathieu Perreault deserves. I don't think we need any more Perreault. You know, I think that, it's interesting because you know that at this point, Stastny is a pro and he is going to do whatever is expected of him. But I don't think that they ever, in their wildest dreams, anticipated that a player like Pierre-Luc Dubois was going to come their way when they made that trade to bring back Stastny in the summer. So
no, I mean, that was kind of, I don't think they ever expected it this early. I knew that I think they kind of expected he'd be available at the end of the season, but not certainly, you know, five games into the season.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that, I guess the line of thinking was that Patrick Laine was probably not long for this team. And I think that most people anticipated that if Laine was going out the door, that a top four defenseman was going to be the centerpiece of the package coming back. I don't think anybody ever anticipated that another top centerman was going to be coming back. And so I think that great on him, because I think that long term, and short-term, Dubois is a better fit for the Jets than Line A probably was at this point. But I think it's going to take some time to kind of shake out. And it's great that they have a couple of games coming up, you know, tonight and I think on Saturday against Ottawa, right? Because while Ottawa definitely showed well in those earlier matchups this year, they are maybe a bit of a weaker team in the North Division. And, you know, maybe you can work some things out, try some combinations out and see what fits.
I think this situation, it puts the Jets in a position that they haven't really been in before, potentially with Stastny, you know, having his role on this team shifted and potentially erased. Like, what could he fetch at the trade deadline in terms of a return? Send him somewhere as a rental, preferably out of the North Division, because the Jets have never really been the team with the big free agent rental. So I think maybe that's what they do here. They send him off somewhere, get some futures, get some assets back that they can turn into a top four defenseman. Yeah, I don't know. I think the Dubois trade completely changed the plans for this team moving forward.
Well, we won't. I mean, I'm going to leave it there. We got about 20 minutes remaining in the show here. So I just want to run over the quick analytics. As everybody knows, I've been keeping track of this on social media. Maurice with no glasses is now 7-3-1 on the season. So everybody is aware. Maurice, no glasses, 7-3-1. Maurice with glasses, 0-1 still. Jets in white, 2-2. Jets in blue, 4-1. Jets in the Aviators, 0-1-1. And Jets in the reverse retros, 1-0. They're also 0-1 with Pierre-Luc Dubois. So there are your analytics for everything that Paul Maurice doesn't like about it. poor Maurice. Not in his analytics. Speaking of analytics, though, the Penguins have completed their GM search, naming two people to the role of GM and president of hockey operations, which didn't exist before. Ron Hextall and Brian Burke, respectively, take over those positions. I'm going to say, just before I let you two go crazy on this, they can't do any worse than Jim Rutherford, so I'm happy with this move. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Ron Hextall is kind of... I think he's really a great pick for Pittsburgh. I was a huge fan of his in Philadelphia, for better or for worse. Like, he was very protective of Carter Hart. He was very much a "we're not going to sell the farm to win now" type. So I think what he gives you is he gives you that flexibility where he's the type of guy that will keep this team where it's at. You're probably going to keep going for it as long as Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin are wearing Penguin sweaters. So he has the ability to do that. He has the knowledge to get that team back on track, because he is a great GM. But also when push comes to shove and it's time to start building for the future and drafting well, he can also do that. I think the more interesting part is Brian Burke and all of this, because, you know, he was the one that said Tony D'Angelo should get a second chance. So I don't know how that's going to shake out with Pittsburgh, but...
Yeah,
I hope it doesn't shake out in Pittsburgh. I'll just say that. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the thing that didn't really fit for me, I'm all for the Hextall hire. And I mean, there were a lot of names that seemed to be bandied about in the days and weeks leading up to it. And he was definitely a candidate right from the jump. And it makes a lot of sense for all the reasons that Jason mentioned. I don't understand the Brian Burke role in it all. I mean, you know, you didn't have anybody in the position before. Ostensibly, Rutherford was the GM and the president of hockey operations, right? I mean, it was one sort of whole package. But I guess you got to figure out, where are the boundaries going to be, right? Is Brian Burke just there in strictly an advisory role? Is he there to sort of shepherd Hextall through what will inevitably come? Because I think that, you know, everybody can see that the Penguins are going to have some sort of rebuild or retooling coming up. You know, I think it's been pretty apparent for this year. And I mean, last year it was apparent early, and then they caught fire and things were good again. But I don't see the reason. If I were a Penguins fan like Teebs, I'd be happy that Jim Rutherford is on his way down the road. But it'll be interesting to see what happens, because I don't follow the Penguins a whole heck of a lot, other than than watching those top couple guys. And I like Jake Gunsel. And I said to Trevor yesterday, I like Brian Rust, but you know, they need to find something on defense. They need to find something between the pipes, because until they do, they're going to have trouble.
I think the interesting thing might be Brian Burke's ability to manage up. You know, he's not going to take crap from people, and he's very good about letting people do what they need to do. And if any of the stories about what led to Rutherford excusing himself from the Penguins organization are in any way true, having a guy that can be that buffer between the GM and ownership, and just to say, like, let the GM do his job, let him do what he needs to do, and let him do the job you hired him to do. I think Brian Burke might be a good buffer like that. But yeah, it's kind of a what exactly are you looking for out of a Brian Burke? But
I think, as a Penguins fan, like Jared said, I mean, I look at this as opportunity for getting better. First of all, Hextall was key to that 2014 sort of start of the rebuild for, like you were saying, you know, Jay, with Carter Hart. But he was the guy that drafted Travis Sanheim. He drafted Oscar Lindblom. He drafted Provorov. He drafted Konechny. He drafted Hart. He drafted Nolan Patrick. Like, those guys have all played significant roles in getting Philadelphia off to the good start they've had this year. He was, you know, instrumental in finding some of the guys that, and keeping some of the guys like Voracek and Giroux in Philadelphia as well. So I'm happy with the way that Hextall manages. I think, like you said, though, Burke is the guy to really sort of drive the hockey operation side of it now and not have that ownership sort of interference, I'll say. I don't really want to say interference, but let's be honest. I mean, Jim Rutherford destroyed this team trying to keep the window open for a chance to win championships by giving out bad contracts to bad players far too often. And if Ron Hextall can look at rebuilding the retooling and sort of restocking the cupboard down in Wilkes-Barre, much like Ray Sherrow did, that will definitely help in the long run. Will it be enough before guys like Malkin, who are 34, and Crosby and Letang, who are both 33, age out? Hard to say, but you got to give them a chance at least, because right now there's nothing in the cupboard. They have no draft picks and they have no depth whatsoever. So I'm happy that Hextall's in there, just because, again, I'm not certain that anybody could have done worse than what Rutherford did in terms of the way he left this organization. And I don't understand how he lasted this long by dismantling the Penguins entirely from top to bottom while maintaining two or three very important pieces. Mm-hmm. Like, it's astounding. But I guess that's neither here nor there now, because Ron Hextall's got the job. So that's good to hear. But I'm happy with it as a Penguins fan. So I'm glad he's in there. But I got to ask you, Jared, because you're going to probably have an opinion on this. We're going to skip over a couple of topics here. But obviously losing the Jets was a huge blow to their success once they left and went over to CGOB. But local radio took a major hit this week with the loss of TSN 1290. As the general manager of a radio station, Jared, you have all sorts of, you know, inside sort of knowledge on how a radio station is run and how it maintains its ability to attract listeners. But thoughts on losing really a sports station that had no competitors in Winnipeg?
First and foremost, what I got to say is, I feel bad for those folks who lost their jobs.
Yes, yeah.
And I feel horrible about the way that it went down. And, you know, you've seen the sort of trickle out of the sort of the background on that. And, you know, Winnipeg was not alone here. Hamilton lost their station. Vancouver lost their station. And I read reports of folks in Winnipeg finding out because members of the media, specifically from the Free Press, contacted them asking what their thoughts were. And they didn't even know that it had happened yet. You know, people were finding out on Twitter here in Winnipeg that they played that Green Day song. was the sign off, right?
Good. It was actually simulcast in Vancouver as well. They did it at the same time. They cut mid commercial. And went to the, like, they were literally switching over at the hour at, I think it was 7 a.m. in Vancouver. They were in a commercial break and they cut from the commercial break to go into a music format. They didn't even tell anybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now you hear that there's not, like, I've heard a lot of different stuff sort of kicked around about the three stations, but that the Winnipeg station is going to become an all comedy format, which
It was registered today. It's going to be called Funny 1290 now.
I've never even heard of an all-comedy radio station in another market. I've never seen something like that tested. And I mean, you know, I'll be the first to admit that my sense of humor is pretty juvenile and that the jokes that I like tend to run a little bit blue and you're probably not going to be able to play them on the radio anyways. But I don't get how that format is going to play here, right?
So a friend of mine, I have a friend of mine who was caught up in kind of the wave of downsizing, streamlining, whatever you want to call it, on the FM side. And from the indication that I got from him, like just like what happened with 1290, nobody was informed of this.
No,
it just happened. He got called in for a meeting with his boss and was just told flat out right there, you're done. And there was no indication that he would have to go find a new job or anything. Basically, like a couple days prior, he had set up that meeting and they were going to talk about salary and his contract and what they were going to do moving forward. So it happened within a few days.
The framing that I got from reading accounts, I mean, I don't know anybody that, I mean, I know guys who were working there, but haven't had a chance to really talk to them or anything. Like, the morning show basically signed off saying, see you tomorrow. And then they were done. And the next shows that were coming in, because we know that they replay some of the hours, they weren't told at all that their show had been, like, there was no other shows being played. Like Jared said, there were members of the media basically texting these guys going, hey, what's going on? And they were like, where are you getting this information from? And this goes back to the whole Bell situation where they've laid off a pile of high profile people now, Natasha Stanishevsky, Dan O'Toole, Brent Wallace, a number of people across the TV and now radio land.
Not to mention, you know, 600 or 700 employees on the telecom side of things and
retail,
you know,
side.
The retail, and this is the problem for me with all of that as well, is people have been talking about the fact that they've collected north of $120 million in federal wage subsidies. And, you know, they're trumpeting the fact to their shareholders that they're posting good numbers. And
let's not lose the fact that they made nearly $1 billion in 3 months.
Hold on. But that's the key though, Jared, what you just brought up, because if they had done this a little more spaced out, it could have been swallowed that, okay, there's been some problems and we could have got out. So what they did is they basically got their charity credit for doing Bell Let's Talk. And then they downsized the company entirely in order to boost their shareholder profits because tax season happens next month. This is entirely a bottom line move that is considerably awful when you look at the bigger picture, because they're going to get the charity benefit. They got the $122 million thrown at them from the federal government. And now they've downsized and improved their bottom line by cutting off some lesser earning pieces of the puzzle. This is entirely a disgusting. And again, we've talked about how hockey values business over humanity. This is Bell corporately saying the exact same thing, is that we value money more than we value people.
Which is ironic given the timing and the big campaign that they ran a couple of weeks ago.
But again, that's just the charity benefit that they're taking it off that. If they hadn't laid anybody off and waited till after tax season, again, they could have gone, well, we've done the budgets and, you know, things aren't looking so good for these stations and maybe we got to, you know, downsize. Again, they could have legitimately played this off a lot smarter if they would have just got their act together, but then they wouldn't have got the big shareholder payout in March. That's the thing.
And I mean, you know, it's been a topic of discussion for folks within the city here that the death knell, for lack of a better term, started when they decided not to pursue a Jets contract. And that's, you know, that's your most marketable asset. That's what most people are tuning into the station to listen to, you know, no deference to some of the home produced programming here. But once the Jets move on to CJOB and Power 97, you have no sort of flagship place. You get nowhere to plant your flag anymore, right? And it's hard to build a consistent brand when you're running repeats of the same program four times in a day, like tape on a loop or syndicated stuff that has no meaning to folks here in the city. I mean, you know, my son, 10 years old, loved 1290, listened nonstop but there also came a point where they would cut over to some of the American syndicated stuff, and he's like, well, why are they talking about this? Where is this coming from? What right, is this? Yeah. What is this map? Right? And so it's unfortunate, because as somebody who is a member of the media fraternity and has been for a long time, it's just, it sucks to see things go down that way. And it sucks to see good people lose their jobs.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, Patterson, you know, Andrew Hustler Patterson and Darren Bauming are both a couple of UMFM
guys that I've worked with
right
in the past.
Right? I mean, great guys, and certainly don't want to see anything bad happen to them. I mean, I've had good interactions in the past with Jim Toth and had some good discussions with him. And I look at this and I just go, like, there were, and again, it comes right back to what you said off the top there, Jared. I mean, there are a lot of good people in a very tough time in the pandemic right now that are out of work because Bell just doesn't give a crap. And it sucks to say that, but it's time that we abolish Bell Let's Talk entirely. And I know that we promoted this a couple weeks ago on the show. I'm not going to deny that, but hindsight now being 2020, we never bring up those three words in that phrasing ever again, because if we're going to talk about Bell Let's Talk, let's talk about you hiring back the 2,000 people you laid off.
I think this is really where Canadian media is so far behind, is that there's this misunderstanding about talent. Like in the US, you look at ESPN, you look at really any TV station, any radio station, and it's all talent driven. It's all the personalities, the people, their own personal brands, because that's what people get attached to. They don't care about, you know, the overall, like, whatever particular radio station they're on. They care about the individual people that they listen to on their drive home from work every day, or the people that they listen to for their favorite show. To lose so many talented people that have really drawn attention and keep people coming back, you know, night after night or day after day, like, that sets you back so much further than anything else.
As one person wrote on social media, it's very hard for me to pay you money when you don't have a product. And that's exactly what it's coming down to, is that mm-hmm. Bell doesn't have a product. They just have a recycled bunch of, and again, I'm not taking away from the hosts that are on TSN or the hosts that, you know, do other shows in four different cities now that where the radio station still exists, but I don't care about those cities. I cared about my city because that was local to me and it mattered to me. And now that I don't have that, I don't care anymore. Like, that's what it comes down to. Like, you burn bridges here through abolishing TSN. And if you're not going to bring it back and you're not going to have people in the city that are going to do this stuff, there's a void there. And I'm not going to deny that. We're lucky that, you know, Jared allows us to come on here and talk hockey for an hour a week. And other shows have, you know, there's a basketball show, there's a baseball show, all sorts of different shows. But outside of CJOB and the shows that are on here on UMFM, there are no other sports shows in Winnipeg. None. Zero. Outside of podcasts. Like, there's a void here now, and you don't get the local focus from Toronto on Winnipeg local sports. You don't get the local focus from Edmonton on Winnipeg local sports. So what are we doing? Like, what is Bell thinking that this is going to accomplish?
Well, I think that, you know, you've already kind of hit the nail on the head, where it's all about the bottom line. It's about, you know, there's a famous sign where when you drive over the Arlington Bridge into the north end of Winnipeg, right, that on a rooftop it says people before profits. And I think that what you're seeing here is it's that sort of ethos in reverse, right? It's this big company, this big faceless corporation that cares about the money more than the people that work for it, more than the people that bring in that revenue, that help to build that culture. And it's really quite disgusting to me. And I mean, I know I keep hammering on that whole campaign that ran a couple weeks ago, but it was interesting this year. And it's been bubbling the last couple of years. You know, you remember the first year that they ran that campaign. It was something that was special to a lot of folks, and it was something that was, you know, did really good things for talking about stigma around mental health and depression and anxiety and things that a lot of us suffer from, or we know people who suffer from. And over, you know, a 4 or 5 year arc, you've seen cracks in that campaign forming. And this year, more so than ever, the number of people that I saw in my social media feed speaking out against that particular campaign versus speaking up for it was almost equal. And I would say that it even sided more with those speaking out, because people see through the facade and you see the anonymous reports from employees talking about how Bell treated them when they were let go. And I cannot see the public buying into whatever crap that they try and shovel out next year. And I really hope that they put it to bed, because it will, if there is any justice, it will blow up in their faces.
And, you know, whenever I walk to the office, when I'm going to work, I have to walk by this massive mural on Gary Street that's dedicated to the 1919 general strike. And it's absolutely maddening to see that 100 years later, after people fought for the people that make these companies so much money, to protect them, to recognize how important people are to situations like this, to corporations, to companies, the engine that drives all of this, to see 100 years later that we're no better than where we were is just, it's really, really sad.
Well, I mean, not to end on a bad note, but I mean, we're pretty much out of time at that point. So gentlemen, we're going to get out of here. Anything you guys want to promote before we get out of here? Anything you want to get off your chest and use a soapbox for?
You know what I'll say? Because I'm not currently doing my own radio show. I'm kind of laid up on the main floor of my house right now, and yeah, all of my recording gear is on the second floor. I will take this opportunity to thank all of the good friends and listeners of UMFM out there whose unwavering support throughout the last year. It's coming up on a year where we have been programming outside the station. It's just been absolutely amazing. And you know, hearing from folks telling us that the consistency that we bring has been something within their own lives that has helped them sort of get through the day to day. So I want to thank, you know, all those listeners for sticking with us and letting us keep doing what we're doing, because, you know, without listeners and without the great volunteers as well, a station like UMFM cannot exist. So that's what I'll
good message there. Nothing wrong with that, Jared.
Yeah. And I'm just going to leave it with Jared. Like he just said, took the words right out of my mouth. You know, support local media, support local journalism. And thank you so much to everybody that tunes in every single day or every week to listen to your favorite shows.
And with that, folks, we're going to get out of here for another week. It's been the Hockey Show. We are glad to be on the air and want to thank Jared for giving us that opportunity every week. And certainly want to thank all of our fans for listening as well. You guys make it so much fun. So hope we'll be back in the studio soon. But until then, until next week, we will see you on Thursday right here on 101.5 UMFM. Stay tuned. Skippy with Free Range Radio coming up next. You're listening to CJUM FM 101.5 in Winnipeg.